All of them regained a little hope. They strained their eyes for any sign of torches and fires in the soldiers' encampment, and imagined they heard men talking and the jingling of horses' harnesses through the whistling wind. Every now and then they saw a glint in the distance or heard a noise, but it was always just the moonlight reflecting on a frozen puddle or a tree creaking in the blizzard. At last they reached the edge of the wide expanse of rock, marsh, and rustling weed, and they realized there were no soldiers there at all. The winter storms had caused a retreat. The commander, who was privately certain there was no Ichabod, had decided that he wasn't going to let his men freeze to death just to please Lord Spittleworth. So he'd given the order to head south, and if it hadn't been for the thick snow, which was still falling so fast it covered all tracks, the friends might have been able to see the soldiers' five-day-old footprints going in the opposite direction. "Look," said Roderick, pointing as he shivered. "They were here." A wagon had been abandoned in the snow because it had got stuck, and the soldiers wanted to escape the storm quickly. The foursome approached the wagon and saw food. Food such as Bert, Daisy, and Roderick remembered only from their dreams, and which Martha had never seen in her life. Heaps of creamy Kurdsberg cheeses, piles of Schuville pastries, sausages, and venison pies of Baronstown, all sent to keep the camp commander and his soldiers happy because there was no food to be had in the marshlands. Bert reached out numb fingers to try and take a pie, but a thick layer of ice now covered the food, and his fingers simply slid off. He turned a hopeless face to Daisy, Martha, and Roderick, all of whose lips were now blue. Nobody said anything. They knew they were going to die of cold on the edge of the Ichabod's marsh, and none of them really cared any longer. Daisy was so cold that to sleep forever seemed a wonderful idea. She barely felt the added chill as she sank slowly into the snow. Bert sank down and put his arms around her, but he too was feeling sleepy and strange. Martha leant up against Roderick, who tried to draw her under his blanket. Huddled together beside the wagon, all four were soon unconscious, and the snow crept up their bodies as the moon began to rise. And then a vast shadow rippled over them. Two enormous arms covered in long green hair like marshweed descended upon the four friends. As easily as if they were babies, the Ichabod scooped them up and bore them away across the marsh. Chapter 51. Inside the Cave. Some hours later, Daisy woke up, but at first she didn't open her eyes. She couldn't remember being this cozy since childhood, when she'd slept beneath a patchwork quilt stitched by her mother and woken every winter morning to the sound of a fire crackling in her grate. She could hear the fire crackling now and smell venison pies heating in the oven, so she knew she must be dreaming that she was back at home with both her parents. But the sound of flames and the smell of pie were so real, it then occurred to Daisy that instead of dreaming, she might be in heaven. Perhaps she'd frozen to death on the edge of the marsh. Without moving her body, she opened her eyes and saw a flickering fire and the rough-hewn walls of what seemed to be a very large cavern, and she realized she and her three companions were lying in a large nest of what seemed to be unspun sheep's wool. There was a gigantic rock beside the fire, which was covered with long, greenish-brown marshweed. Daisy gazed at this rock until her eyes became accustomed to the semi-darkness. Only then did she realize that the rock, which was as tall as two horses, was looking back at her. Even though the old story said the Ichabod looked like a dragon or a serpent or a drifting ghoul, Daisy knew at once that this was the real thing. In panic, she closed her eyes again, reached out a hand through the soft mass of sheep's wool, found one of the other's backs, and poked it. "What?" whispered Bert. "Have you seen it?" whispered Daisy, eyes still tightly shut. "Yes," breathed Bert. "Don't look at it."
"I'm not," said Daisy.
"I told you there was an Ichabod," came Martha's terrified whisper. "I think it's cooking pies," whispered Roderick. All four lay quite still, with their eyes closed, until the smell of venison pie became so deliciously overpowering that each of them felt it would be almost worth dying to jump up, snatch a pie, and maybe wolf down a few mouthfuls before the Ichabod could kill them. Then they heard the monster moving. Its long, coarse hair rustled, and its heavy feet made loud, muffled thumps. There was a clunk, as though the monster had laid down something heavy. Then a low, booming voice said, "Eat them." All four opened their eyes. You might think the fact that the Ichabod could speak their language would be a huge shock, but they were already so stunned that the monster was real, that it knew how to make fires, and that it was cooking venison pies, that they barely stopped to consider that point. The Ichabod had placed a rough-hewn wooden platter of pies beside them on the floor, and they realized it must have taken them from the frozen stock of food on the abandoned wagon. Slowly and cautiously, the four friends moved into sitting positions, staring up into the large, mournful eyes of the Ichabod, which peered at them through the tangle of long, coarse, greenish hair that covered it from head to foot. Roughly shaped like a person, it had a truly enormous belly and huge, shaggy paws, each of which had a single sharp claw.
"What do you want with us?" asked Bert bravely.
In its deep, booming voice, the Ichabod replied, "I'm going to eat you, but not yet." The Ichabod turned, picked up a pair of baskets, which were woven from strips of bark, and walked away to the mouth of the cave. Then, as though a sudden thought had struck it, the Ichabod turned back to them and said, "Roar." It didn't actually roar. It simply said the word. The four teenagers stared at the Ichabod, which blinked, then turned round and walked out of the cave, a basket in each paw. Then a boulder as large as the cave mouth rumbled its way across the entrance to keep the prisoners inside. They listened as the Ichabod's footsteps crunched through the snow outside and died away. Chapter 52 Mushrooms. Never would Daisy and Martha forget the taste of those Barrenstown pies after the long years of cabbage soup at Ma Grunter's. Indeed, Martha burst into tears after the first bite and said she'd never known food could be like this. All of them forgot about the Ichabod while eating. Once they'd finished the pies, they felt braver, and they got up to explore the Ichabod's cave by the light of the fire. "Look," said Daisy, who had found drawings on the wall. 100 shaggy Ichabods
were being chased by stick men with spears.
"See this one," said Roderick, pointing at a drawing close to the mouth of the cave.
By the light of the Ichabod's fire, the foursome examined a picture of a lone Ichabod standing face to face with a stick figure wearing a plumed helmet and holding a sword.
"That looks like the king," whispered Daisy, pointing at the figure. "You don't think he really saw the Ichabod that night, do you?"
The others couldn't answer, of course, but I can. I'll tell you the whole truth now, and I hope you won't be annoyed that I didn't before.
Fred really did catch a glimpse of the Ichabod in the thick marsh mist that fatal night when Major Beamish was shot. I can also tell you that the following morning, the old shepherd, who'd thought his dog had been eaten by the Ichabod, heard a whining and scratching at the door and realized that faithful Patch had come home again, because, of course, Spittleworth had set the dog free from the brambles in which he was trapped.
Before you judge the old shepherd too harshly for not letting the king know that Patch hadn't been eaten by the Ichabod after all, you should remember that he was weary after his long journey to Shoeville. In any case, the king wouldn't have cared. Once Fred had seen the monster through the mist, nothing and nobody would have persuaded him it wasn't real.
"I wonder," said Martha, "why the Ichabod didn't eat the king."
"Maybe he really did fight it off, like the stories say?" asked Roderick doubtfully.
"You know, it's strange," said Daisy, turning to look at the Ichabod's cave, "that there aren't any bones in here, if the Ichabod eats people."
"It must eat the bones, too," said Bert. His voice was shaking. Now Daisy remembered that, of course, they must have been wrong in thinking that Major Beamish had died in an accident on the marsh. Clearly, the Ichabod had killed him, after all. She'd just reached for Bert's hand to show him she knew how horrible it was for him to be in the lair of his father's killer, when they heard heavy footsteps outside again and knew the monster had returned. All four dashed back to the soft pile of sheep's wool and sat down in it as though they'd never moved. There was a loud rumble as the Ichabod rolled back the stone, letting in the wintry chill. It was still snowing hard outside, and the Ichabod had a lot of snow trapped in its hair. In one of its baskets, it had a large number of mushrooms and some firewood. In the other, it had some frozen Shoeville pastries. While the teenagers watched, the Ichabod built up the fire again and placed the icy block of pastries on a flat stone beside it, where they slowly began to thaw. Then, while Daisy, Bert, Martha, and Roderick watched, the Ichabod began eating mushrooms. It had a curious way of doing so. It speared a few at a time on the single spike protruding from each paw, then picked them off delicately in its mouth, one by one, chewing them up with what looked like great enjoyment. After a while, it seemed to become aware that the four humans were watching it.
"Roar,"
it said again, and fell back to ignoring them until it had eaten all the mushrooms, after which it carefully lifted the unfrozen Shoeville pastries off the warm rock and offered them to the humans in its huge, hairy paws.
"It's trying to fatten us up," said Martha in a terrified whisper,
but nevertheless she seized a folderol fancy, and the next second her eyes were closed in ecstasy. After the Ichabod and the humans had eaten, the Ichabod put its two baskets away tidily in a corner, poked up the fire, and moved to the mouth of the cave, where the snow continued to fall and the sun was beginning to set. With a strange noise you'd recognize if you've ever heard a bagpipe inflate before somebody starts to play it, the Ichabod drew in breath and began to sing in a language none of the humans could understand. The song echoed forth over the marsh as darkness fell. The four teenagers listened and soon felt drowsy, and one by one they sank back into the nest of sheep's wool and fell asleep. Chapter 53. The Mysterious Monster. It was several days before Daisy, Bert, Martha and Roderick plucked up the courage to do anything other than eat the frozen food that the Ichabod brought them from the wagon and watch the monster eat the mushrooms it foraged for itself. Whenever the Ichabod went out, always rolling the enormous boulder into the mouth of the cave to stop them escaping, they discussed its strange ways, but in low voices, in case it was lurking on the other side of the boulder, listening. One thing they argued about was whether the Ichabod was a boy or a girl. Daisy, Bert and Roderick all thought it must be male because of the booming depth of its voice. But Martha, who'd looked after sheep before her family had starved to death, thought the Ichabod was a girl. "Its belly's growing," she told them. "I think it's going to have babies." The other thing the children discussed, of course, was exactly when the Ichabod was likely to eat them, and whether they were going to be able to fight it off when it tried. "I think we've got a bit of time yet," said Bert, looking at Daisy and Martha, who were still very skinny from their time at the orphanage. "You two wouldn't make much of a meal." "If I got it round the back of the neck," said Roderick, miming the action, "and Bert hit it really hard in the stomach." "We'll never be able to overpower the Ichabod," said Daisy. "It can move a boulder as big as itself. We're nowhere near strong enough." "If only we had a weapon," said Bert, standing up and kicking a stone across the cave. "Don't you think it's odd," said Daisy, "that all we've seen the Ichabod eat is mushrooms? Don't you feel as though it's pretending to be fiercer than it really is?" "It eats sheep," said Martha. "Where did all this wool come from if it hasn't eaten sheep?" "Maybe it just saved up wisps of wool caught on brambles," suggested Daisy, picking up a bit of the soft white fluff. "I still don't understand why there aren't any bones in here if it's in the habit of eating creatures." "What about that song it sings every night?" said Bert. "It gives me the creeps. If you ask me, that's a battle song."
"It scares me too," agreed Martha.
"I wonder what it means," said Daisy. A few minutes later, the giant boulder at the mouth of the cave shifted again, and the Ichabod reappeared with its two baskets, one full of mushrooms, as usual, and the other packed with frozen Kurdsberg cheeses. Everyone ate without talking, as they always did, and after the Ichabod had tidied away its baskets and poked up the fire, it moved, as the sun was setting, to the mouth of the cave, ready to sing its strange song in the language the humans couldn't understand. Daisy stood up.
"What are you doing?" whispered Bert, grabbing her ankle. "Sit down."
"No," said Daisy, pulling herself free. "I want to talk to it." So she walked boldly to the mouth of the cave and sat down beside the Ichabod. Chapter 54. The Song of the Ichabod. The Ichabod had just drawn breath with its usual sound of an inflating bagpipe when Daisy said, "What language do you sing in, Ichabod?" The Ichabod looked down at her, startled to find Daisy so close. At first, Daisy thought it wasn't going to answer, but at last it said in its slow, deep voice,
"Icarish."
"And what's the song about?"
"It's the story of Ichabogs, and of your kind, too."
"You mean people?" asked Daisy.
"People, yes," said the Ichabod. The two stories are one story, because people were bonded out of Ichabogs.
It drew in its breath to sing again, but Daisy asked, "What does bonded mean? Is it the same as born?"
"No," said the Ichabog, looking down at her. "Bonded is very different from being born. It's how new Ichabogs come to be."
Daisy wanted to be polite, seeing how enormous the Ichabog was, so she said cautiously, "That does sound a bit like being born."
"Well, it isn't," said the Ichabog in its deep voice. "Born and bonded are very different things. When babies are bonded, we who have bonded them die."
"Always?" asked Daisy, noticing how the Ichabog absent-mindedly rubbed its tummy as it spoke.
"Always," said the Ichabog. "That is the way of the Ichabog. To live with your children is one of the strangenesses of people."
"But that's so sad," said Daisy slowly, "to die when your children are born."
"It isn't sad at all," said the Ichabog. "The bonding is a glorious thing. Our whole lives lead up to the bonding. What we're doing and what we're feeling when our babies are bonded gives them their natures. It is very important to have a good bonding."
"I don't understand," said Daisy.
"If I die sad and hopeless," explained the Ichabog, "my babies won't survive. I've watched my fellow Ichabogs die in despair, one by one, and their babies survived them only by seconds. An Ichabog can't live without hope. I'm the last Ichabog left, and my bonding will be the most important bonding in history, because if my bonding goes well, our species will survive. And if not, Ichabogs will be gone forever. All our troubles began from a bad bonding, you know."
"Is that what your song's about?" asked Daisy. "The bad bonding?"
The Ichabog nodded, its eyes fixed on the darkening snowy marsh. Then it took yet another deep bagpipe breath and began to sing. And this time it sang in words that the humans could understand. "At the dawn of time, when only Ichabogs existed, stony man was not created, with his cold, flint-hearted ways. Then the world in its perfection was like heaven's bright reflection. No one hunted us or harmed us in those lost, beloved days. Oh, Ichabogs, come bonding back. Come bonding back, my Ichabogs. Oh, Ichabogs, come bonding back. Come bonding back, my own." Then tragedy. One stormy night came bitterness. Bonded of fright and bitterness, so tall and stout, was different from its fellows. Its voice was rough, its ways were mean. The likes of it had not been seen before. And so they drove it out with angry blows and bellows. Oh, Ichabogs, be bonded wise. Be bonded wise, my Ichabogs. Oh, Ichabogs, be
Be born did wise, be born did wise, my own. A thousand miles from its own home, its bonding time arrived. Alone in darkness, bitterness expired, and hatred came to be. A hairless Ichabod, this last. A beast sworn to avenge the past. With bloodlust was the creature fired, its evil eye far-seeing. Oh, Ichabogs, be born did kind. Be born did kind, my Ichabogs. Oh, Ichabogs, be born did kind. Be born did kind, my own. Then hatred spawned the race of man. 'Twas from ourselves that man began. From bitterness and hate they swelled to armies, raised to smite us. In hundreds Ichabogs were slain. Our blood poured on the land like rain. Our ancestors like trees were felled, and still men came to fight us. Oh, Ichabogs, be born did brave, be born did brave, my Ichabogs. Oh, Ichabogs, be born did brave, be born did brave, my own. Men forced us from our sunlit home, away from grass to mud and stone, into the endless fog and rain, and here we stayed and dwindled, till of our race there's only one, survivor of the spear and gun, whose children must begin again, with hate and fury kindled. Oh, Ichabogs, now kill the men. Now kill the men, my Ichabogs. Oh, Ichabogs, now kill the men. Now kill the men, my own. Daisy and the Ichabog sat in silence for a while. After the Ichabog had finished singing, the stars were coming out now. Daisy fixed her eyes on the moon as she said, "How many people have you eaten, Ichabog?" The Ichabog sighed.
"None so far. Ichabogs like mushrooms."
"Are you planning on eating us when your bonding time comes?" Daisy asked. "So your babies are born believing Ichabogs eat people? You want to turn them into people killers, don't you, to take back your land?" The Ichabog looked down at her. It didn't seem to want to answer, but at last it nodded its huge, shaggy head. Behind Daisy and the Ichabog, Bert, Martha, and Roderick exchanged terrified glances by the light of the dying fire.
"I know what it's like to lose the people you love the most," said Daisy quietly. "My mother died, and my father disappeared. For a long time after my father went away, I made myself believe that he was still alive because I had to, or I think I'd have died as well."
Daisy got to her feet to look up into the Ichabog's sad eyes. "I think people need hope nearly as much as Ichabogs do. But," she said, placing her hand over her heart, "my mother and father are both still in here, and they always will be. So when you eat me, Ichabog, eat my heart last. I'd like to keep my parents alive as long as I can."
She walked back into the cave, and the four humans settled down on their piles of wool again, beside the fire. A little later, sleepy though she was, Daisy thought she heard the Ichabog sniff.
Chapter 55. Spittleworth offends the king. After the disaster of the runaway mail coach, Lord Spittleworth took steps to make sure such a thing would never happen again. A new proclamation was issued, without the king's knowledge, which allowed the chief adviser to open letters to check them for signs of treason. The proclamation notices helpfully listed all the things that were now considered treason in Cornucopia. It was still treason to say that the Ichabog wasn't real and that Fred wasn't a good king. It was treason to criticise Lord Spittleworth and Lord Flapoon, treason to say the Ichabog tax was too high, and, for the first time, treason to say that Cornucopia wasn't as happy and well-fed as it had always been. Now that everybody was too frightened to tell the truth in their letters, mail, and even travel to the capital dwindled to almost nothing, which was exactly what Spittleworth had wanted, and he started on phase two of his plan. This was to send a lot of fan mail to Fred. As these letters couldn't all have the same handwriting, Spittleworth had shut up a few soldiers in a room with a stack of paper and lots of quills and told them what to write. "Praise the king, of course," said Spittleworth as he swept up and down in front of the men in his chief adviser's robes. "Tell him he's the best ruler the country's ever had. Praise me, too. Say that you don't know what would become of Cornucopia without Lord Spittleworth, and say you know the Ichabog would have killed many more people if not for the Ichabog Defence Brigade, and that Cornucopia's richer than ever." So Fred began to receive letters telling him how marvellous he was, and that the country had never been happier, and that the war against the Ichabog was going very well indeed. "Well, it appears everything's going splendidly," beamed King Fred, waving one of these letters over lunch with the two lords. He'd been much more cheerful since the forgeries had started to arrive. The bitter winter had frozen the ground so that it was dangerous to go hunting, but Fred, who was wearing a gorgeous new costume of burnt orange silk with topaz buttons, felt particularly handsome today, which added to his cheerfulness. It was quite delightful watching the snow tumble down outside the window when he had a blazing fire and his table was piled high, as usual, with expensive foodstuffs. "I had no idea so many Ichabogs had been killed, Spittleworth. In fact, come to think of it, I didn't even know there was more than one Ichabog."
Yes, sire," said Spittleworth with a furious glance at Flapoon, who was stuffing himself with a particularly delicious cream cheese.
Spittleworth had so much to do, he'd given Flapoon the job of checking all the forged letters before they were sent to the king.
We didn't wish to alarm you, but we realized some time ago that the monster had—he
coughed delicately.
reproduced.
"I see," said Fred. "Well, it's jolly good news you're finishing them off at such a rate. We should have one stuffed, you know, and hold an exhibition for the people."
"Yes, sire, what an excellent idea," said Spittleworth through gritted teeth.
"One thing I don't understand, though," said Fred, frowning over the letter again. "Didn't Professor Frodisham say that every time an Ichabog dies, two grow in its place? By killing them like this, aren't you in fact doubling their numbers?"
No, sire, not really," said Spittleworth, his cunning mind working furiously fast.
We've actually found a way of stopping that happening by banging them over the head first," suggested Flapoon.
Banging them over the head first, repeated Spittleworth, nodding. That's it. If you can get near enough to knock them out before killing them, sire, the doubling process seems to stop.
But why didn't you tell me of this amazing discovery, Spittleworth? Cried Fred. This changes everything. We might soon have wiped Ichabogs from cornucopia forever.
Yes, sire, it is good news, isn't it? Said Spittleworth, wishing he could smack the smile off Flapoon's face. However, there are still quite a few Ichabogs left.
All the same, the end seems to be in sight at last, said Fred joyfully, setting the letter aside and picking up his knife and fork again. How very sad that poor Major Roach was killed by an Ichabog just before we began to turn the tables on the monsters.
Very sad, sire, yes, agreed Spittleworth, who, of course, had explained away Major Roach's sudden disappearance by telling the king he had laid down his life in the marshlands, trying to prevent the Ichabog coming south.
Well, this all makes sense of something I've been wondering about, said Fred. The servants are constantly singing the national anthem. Have you heard them? Jolly uplifting and all that, but it does become a bit samey. But this is why. They're celebrating our triumph over the Ichabogs, aren't they?
That must be it, sire, said Spittleworth. In fact, the singing was coming from the prisoners in the dungeons, not the servants. But Fred was unaware that he had 50 or so people trapped in the dungeons beneath him.
We should hold a ball in celebration, said Fred. We haven't had a ball for a very long time. It seems an age since I danced with Lady Eslander.
Nuns don't dance, said Spittleworth crossly. He stood up abruptly.
Flapoon, a word.
The two lords were halfway towards the door when the king commanded,
Wait!
Both turned. King Fred looked suddenly displeased.
Neither of you asked permission to leave the king's table.
The two lords exchanged glances. Then Spittleworth bowed and Flapoon copied him.
I crave your majesty's pardon, said Spittleworth. It's simply that if we are to act on your excellent suggestion of having a dead Ichabog stuffed, sire, we must act quickly. It might rot otherwise.
All the same, said Fred, fingering the golden medal he wore around his neck, which was embossed with the picture of the king fighting a dragonish monster, I remain the king, Spittleworth, your king.
Of course, sire, said Spittleworth, bowing low again. I live only to serve you.
Said Fred. Well, see that you remember it, and be quick about stuffing that Ichabog. I wish to display it to the people. Then we shall discuss the celebration ball.
Chapter 56 The Dungeon Plot. As soon as Spittleworth and Flapoon were out of earshot of the king, Spittleworth rounded on Flapoon.
You were supposed to check all those letters before giving them to the king. Where am I supposed to find a dead Ichabog to stuff?
Sew something, suggested Flapoon with a shrug.
Sew something? Sew something?
Well, what else could you do? Said Flapoon, taking a large bite of the Duke's delight he had sneaked from the king's table.
What can I do? Repeated Spittleworth, incensed. You think this is all my problem?
You were the one who invented the Ichabog, said Flapoon thickly as he chewed.
He was getting very bored of Spittleworth shouting at him and bossing him about.
And you're the one who killed Beamish, snarled Spittleworth. Where would you be now if I hadn't blamed the monster?
Without waiting for Flapoon's response, Spittleworth turned and headed down to the dungeons.
At the very least, he could stop the prisoners singing the national anthem so loudly, so the king might think the war against the Ichabogs had taken a turn for the worse again.
"Quiet! Quiet!"
bellowed Spittleworth as he entered the dungeon, because the place was ringing with noise. There was singing and laughter, and Cankerby the footman was running between the cells, fetching and carrying kitchen equipment for all the different prisoners, and the smell of maiden's dreams, fresh from Mrs. Beamish's oven, filled the warm air. The prisoners all looked far better fed than the last time Spittleworth had been down here. He didn't like this, didn't like it at all. He especially didn't like to see Captain Goodfellow looking as fit and strong as ever he had. Spittleworth liked his enemies weak and hopeless. Even Mr. Dovetail looked as though he'd trimmed his long white beard.
"You are keeping track, aren't you?"
he asked the panting Cankerby, "of all these pots and knives and whatnots you're handing out."
Of course, my lord," gasped the footman,
not liking to admit that he was so confused by all the orders Mrs. Beamish was giving him that he had no idea which prisoner had what. Spoons, whisks, ladles, saucepans, and baking trays had to be passed between the bars to keep up with the demand for Mrs. Beamish's pastries, and once or twice Cankerby had accidentally passed one of Mr. Dovetail's chisels to another prisoner. He thought he collected everything in at the end of each night, but how on earth was he to be sure? And sometimes Cankerby worried that the warder of the dungeon, who was fond of wine, might not hear the prisoners whispering to each other if they took it into their heads to plot anything after the candles were snuffed out at night. However, Cankerby could tell that Spittleworth was in no mood to have problems brought to him, so the footman held his tongue.
"There will be no more singing!" shouted Spittleworth, his voice echoing through the dungeon. "The king has a headache!"
In fact, it was Spittleworth whose head was beginning to throb. He forgot the prisoners as soon as he turned his back on them and fell back to pondering how on earth he was going to make a convincing stuffed Ichabog. Perhaps Flapoon was on to something. Might they take the skeleton of a bull and kidnap a seamstress to stitch a dragonish covering over the bones and pad it out with sawdust? Lies upon lies upon lies. Once you started lying, you had to continue, and then it was like being captain of a leaky ship, always plugging holes in the side to stop yourself sinking. Lost in thoughts of skeletons and sawdust, Spittleworth had no idea that he'd just turned his back on what promised to be his biggest problem yet, a dungeon full of plotting prisoners, each of whom had knives and chisels hidden beneath their blankets and behind loose bricks in their walls. Chapter 57 Daisy's Plan. Up in the marshlands, where the snow still lay thick upon the ground, the Ichabog was no longer pushing the boulder in front of the cave mouth when it went out with its baskets. Instead, Daisy, Bert, Martha, and Roderick were helping it collect the little marsh mushrooms it liked to eat. And during these outings, they also prized more frozen food from the abandoned wagon, which they took back to the cave for themselves. All four humans were growing stronger and healthier by the day. The Ichabog, too, was growing fatter and fatter, but this was because its bonding time was drawing ever closer. As the bonding was when the Ichabog said it intended on eating the four humans, Bert, Martha, and Roderick weren't very happy about the Ichabog's growing belly. Bert, in particular, was certain the Ichabog meant to kill them. He now believed he'd been wrong about his father having an accident. The Ichabog was real. So, Clearly, the Ichabod had killed Major Beamish. Often, on their mushrooming trips, the Ichabod and Daisy would draw a little ahead of the others, having their own private conversation.
"What do you think they're talking about?"
Martha whispered to the two boys as they searched the bog for the small white mushrooms the Ichabod particularly liked.
"I think she's trying to make friends with it," said Bert.
"What, so it'll eat us instead of her?" said Roderick.
"That's a horrible thing to say," said Martha sharply. "Daisy looked after everyone at the orphanage. Sometimes she took punishments for other people too."
Roderick was taken aback. He'd been taught by his father to expect the worst of everybody he met, and that the one way to get on in life was to be the biggest, the strongest, and the meanest in every group. It was hard to lose the habits he'd been taught, but with his father dead and his mother and brothers doubtless in prison, Roderick didn't want these three new friends to dislike him.
"Sorry," he muttered, and Martha smiled at him.
Now, as it happened, Bert was quite right. Daisy was making friends with the Ichabod, but her plan wasn't only to save herself or even her three friends. It was to save the whole of Cornucopia. As she and the monster walked through the bog on this particular morning, drawing ahead of the others, she noticed that a few snowdrops had managed to force their way up through a patch of melting ice. Spring was coming, which meant soldiers would soon be returning to the edge of the marsh. With a funny seasick feeling in her stomach, because she knew how important it was that she got this right, Daisy said,
"Ichabod, you know the song you sing every night?"
The Ichabod, who was lifting a log to see whether there were any mushrooms hiding beneath it, said,
"If I didn't know it, I couldn't sing it, could I?"
It gave a wheezy little chuckle.
"Well, you know how you sing that you want your children to be kind and wise and brave?"
"Yes,"
agreed the Ichabod, and it picked up a small silvery grey mushroom and showed it to Daisy.
"That's a good one. You don't get many silver ones on the marsh."
"Lovely," said Daisy, as the Ichabod popped the mushroom into its basket. "And then, in the last chorus of your song, you say you hope that your babies will kill people," said Daisy.
"Yes,"
said the Ichabod again, reaching up to pull a small bit of yellowish fungus off a dead tree and showing it to Daisy.
"This is poisonous. Never eat this kind."
"I won't," said Daisy.
And drawing a deep breath, she said,
"But do you really think a kind, wise, brave Ichabod would eat people?"
The Ichabod stopped in the act of bending to pick up another silvery mushroom and peered down at Daisy.
"I don't want to eat you," it said, "but I have to, or my children will die."
"You said they need hope," said Daisy. "What if, when the bonding time comes, they saw their mother or their father? I'm sorry, I don't quite know."
"I will be their Icker," said the Ichabod, "and they'll be my Ichaboggles."
"Well then, wouldn't it be wonderful if your Ichaboggles saw their Icker surrounded by people who love it and want it to be happy and to live with them as friends? Wouldn't that fill them with more hope than anything else could do?"
The Ichabod sat down on a fallen tree trunk, and for a long time it said nothing at all. Bert, Martha, and Roderick stood watching from a distance. They could tell something very important was happening between Daisy and the Ichabod, and although they were extremely curious, they didn't dare approach. At last the Ichabod said,
Perhaps it would be better if I didn't eat you, Daisy."
This was the first time the Ichabod had called her by her name. Daisy reached out and placed her hand in the Ichabod's paw.
and for a moment the two smiled at each other. Then the Ichabog said,
"When my bonding comes, you and your friends must surround me, and my Ichaboggles will be bonded, knowing you're their friends too. And after that, you must stay with my Ichaboggles here on the marsh forever."
"Well, the problem with that is,"
said Daisy cautiously, still holding the Ichabog's paw,
"that the food on the wagon will run out soon. I don't think there are enough mushrooms here to support the four of us and your Ichaboggles too."
Daisy found it strange to be talking like this about a time when the Ichabog wouldn't be alive, but the Ichabog didn't seem to mind.
"Then what can we do?"
it asked her, its big eyes anxious.
"Ichabog," said Daisy cautiously, "people are dying all over Cornucopia. They're starving to death and even being murdered, all because some evil men made everyone believe you wanted to kill people."
"I did want to kill people until I met you four," said the Ichabog.
"But now you've changed," said Daisy.
She got to her feet and faced the Ichabog, holding both of its paws.
"Now you understand that people, most people anyway, aren't cruel or wicked. They're mostly sad and tired, Ichabog. And if they knew you, how kind you are, how gentle, how all you eat is mushrooms, they'd understand how stupid it is to fear you. I'm sure they'd want you and your Ichaboggles to leave the marsh and go back to the meadows where your ancestors lived, where there are bigger, better mushrooms, and for your descendants to live with us as our friends."
"You want me to leave the marsh," said the Ichabog, "to go among men with their guns and their spears?"
"Ichabog, please listen," begged Daisy. "If your Ichaboggles are bonded, surrounded by hundreds of people, all wanting to love and protect them, wouldn't that feed them more hope than any Ichaboggle ever had in history? Whereas, if the four of us stay here on the marsh and starve to death, what hope will remain for your Ichaboggles?"
The monster stared at Daisy, and Bert, Martha, and Roderick watched, wondering what on earth was happening. At last, a huge tear welled in the Ichabog's eye like a glass apple.
"I'm afraid to go among the men. I'm afraid they'll kill me and my Ichaboggles."
"They won't," said Daisy, letting go of the Ichabog's paw and placing her hands instead on either side of the Ichabog's huge, hairy face, so her fingers were buried in its long, marsh-weedy hair. "I swear to you, Ichabog, we'll protect you. Your bonding will be the most important in history. We're going to bring Ichabogs back. And Cornucopia, too."
Chapter 58. Hetty Hopkins. When Daisy first told the others her plan, Bert refused to be part of it.
"Protect that monster? I won't," he said fiercely. "I took a vow to kill it, Daisy. The Ichabog murdered my father."
"But it didn't," Daisy said. "It's never killed anyone. Please listen to what it's got to say."
So that night, in the cave, Bert, Martha, and Roderick drew close to the Ichabog for the first time, always having been too scared before, and it told the four humans the story of the night years before when it had come face to face with a man in the fog.
"With yellow face hair," said the Ichabog, pointing at its own upper lip.
"Mustaches," suggested Daisy.
"And a twinkly sword."
"Jeweled," said Daisy. "It must have been the king."
"And who else did you meet?" asked Bert.
"Nobody," said the Ichabod. "I ran away and hid behind a boulder. Men killed all my ancestors. I was afraid."
"Well, then, how did my father die?" demanded Bert.
"Was your Icker the one who was shot by the big gun?" asked the Ichabod. "Shot?" repeated Bert, turning pale.
"How do you know this if you'd run away?"
"I was looking out from behind the boulder," said the Ichabod. "Ichabogs can see well in fog. I was frightened. I wanted to see what the men were doing on the marsh. One man was shot by another man."
"Flapoon!" burst out Roderick at last. He'd been afraid to tell Bert before now, but he couldn't hold it in any longer. "Bert, I once heard my father tell my mother he owed his promotion to Lord Flapoon and his blunderbuss. I was really young. I didn't realise what he meant at the time. I'm sorry I never told you. I was afraid of what you'd say." Bert said nothing at all for several minutes. He was remembering that terrible night in the blue parlour when he'd found his father's cold, dead hand and pulled it from beneath the cornucopian flag for his mother to kiss. He remembered Spittleworth saying that they couldn't see his father's body, and he remembered Lord Flapoon spraying him and his mother with pie crumbs as he said how much he'd always liked Major Beamish. Bert put a hand to his chest, where his father's medal lay close against his skin, turned to Daisy, and said in a low voice, "All right, I'm with you." So the four humans and the Ichabod began to put Daisy's plan into operation, acting quickly, because the snow was melting fast and they feared the return of the soldiers to the marshlands. First, they took the enormous empty wooden platters that had borne the cheese, pies and pastries they'd already eaten, and Daisy carved words into them. Next, the Ichabod helped the two boys pull the wagon out of the mud, while Martha collected as many mushrooms as she could find to keep the Ichabod well fed on the journey south. At dawn on the third day, they set out. They'd planned things very carefully. The Ichabod pulled the wagon, which was loaded up with the last of the frozen food and with baskets of mushrooms. In front of the Ichabod walked Bert and Roderick, who were each carrying a sign. Bert's read, "The Ichabod is harmless." Roderick said, "Spittleworth has lied to you." Daisy was riding on the Ichabog's shoulders. Her sign read, "The Ichabod eats only mushrooms." Martha rode in the wagon along with the food and a large bunch of snowdrops, which were part of Daisy's plan. Martha's sign read, "Up with the Ichabod! Down with Lord Spittleworth!" For many miles, they met nobody. But as midday approached, they came across two ragged people leading a single, very thin sheep. This tired and hungry pair were none other than Hetty Hopkins, the maid who'd had to give her children to Ma Grunter, and her husband. They'd been walking the country trying to find work, but nobody had any to give them. Finding the starving sheep in the road, they'd brought it along with them, but its wool was so thin and stringy that it wasn't worth any money.